It is Thursday morning, which is the day we often take a look at your health, and today we'll take a look at your eyes. If you've had problems after LASIK eye surgery, the Food and Drug Administration wants to know. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on a system that tracks complications, and also on what you should know if you're considering laser eye surgery.
Lots of us know someone, a colleague, cousin, or friend, who's had LASIK eye surgery and loves the results. The freedom from glasses or contacts is liberating, and 20/20 vision can feel nothing short of a miracle. But about 5% of patients who have the procedure are not satisfied. It's a small fraction, but with almost a million surgeries each year, there are thousands of complaints. Take patient Joseph Schnell, who had LASIK 2 years ago.
If I look to the extreme left, I can see like a double of everything. It's hard for me to focus. It's even more pronounced when I'm tired.
Schnell is a 48-year-old tradesman who builds elevators for a living. He says his night vision is a problem. When he looks at streetlights or headlights, he sees starbursts where the light explodes out as if he were staring at a sparkler. Schnell says he used to be a very confident driver.
Now it's sometimes I see headlights come any other way. It's just like I'm not sure if I see everything clearly beyond the headlights because they're just the halos and the starbursts. I just don't know if I'm really being safe.
Schnell says when he had LASIK, he did not meet his surgeon until a few minutes before the procedure. He says the technician and optometrist who did the pre-surgical exams didn't make much time for questions.
I had to pull her teeth as far as getting information out of her.
And one thing never mentioned, LASIK will not fix or prevent the decline in close-up vision, which necessitates reading glasses.
No one ever told me that.
Schnell says in retrospect, he could have demanded more information. LASIK centers require patients to sign forms disclosing the risk of complications, but patients don't always read or understand the fine print.
I mean, I share definitely part of the blame for going ahead with this surgery.
But when he spoke publicly at a Food and Drug Administration hearing about LASIK, he found himself in the company of many other patients who say they deserved more warnings and more discussion with doctors about the risks up front.
I do think it's possible that patients may not always be getting all of their questions asked.
Surgeon Kerry Solomon is a leader in the American Society of Cataract and Refractive Surgery. He says if people have unanswered questions before the surgery, they should hold off. The give and take is critical and should be standard.
If a patient's in a position where they don't feel people really haven't had a discussion with them about risks and they're not comfortable with that, then I would get a second opinion.
The FDA says it's not certain how many LASIK patients have problems with their vision weeks or months after their surgeries. The agency's planning a new study to get a better handle on the prevalence. It's scheduled to begin next year. But there's also a way for individual consumers to report their complications with LASIK directly to the FDA. To do so, you fill out a form on the FDA website. The agency's Mary Wick Brady says it takes about 10 minutes.
We encourage as much information as possible here because FDA does look at every voluntary report that comes in.
And the agency uses them to help determine if some new action is needed. When we logged on to try to find this form, we found we needed a little direction. So we got to the FDA homepage.
Okay.
What do we do next?
If you look on the right-hand column, there's an area that says report a problem.
The page looks a bit like a multiple choice test. The X you're looking for is the one marked adverse event. This is just a jargony phrase which means a bad outcome.
If it's a decrease in vision, if it's a halo, if it's a starburst, if it's a problem with night vision, these types of things would be considered adverse events to FDA, and we would want those reported because it has affected your vision.
In the last decade, the FDA has received only about 140 of these adverse event reports, nowhere near the number of patients that surveys and studies estimate to be dissatisfied. It's possible that the unfortunate stories such as Joseph Schnell's are few and far between, but it's also possible that surgeons and patients have underreported complications. To protect yourself before opting to have the surgery, experts say you should make sure you get a thorough screening.
It's not uncommon for us to bring the patient in two or three times.
Surgeon Scott McRae of the University of Rochester says conditions such as dry eye or corneal irregularities need to be checked out in detail and may make an individual a poor candidate for the surgery. If the system of screening and consultation can be improved upon, it's possible that the 95% satisfaction rate with LASIK could rise even higher. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
If you're wondering whether you might be a good candidate for LASIK or wondering how to choose a surgeon, you can get some answers from physicians and also answers to other questions at npr.org/yourhealth. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Rain has been falling over the southeast this spring, but the area is still in a drought, especially the state of Georgia. Lake Lanier, Atlanta's largest source of drinking water, is more than 14 feet below the normal level. But in Clayton County, which is south of Atlanta, people are not so worried. Nearly two decades ago, this county began building an unusual water treatment system that includes wetlands and reservoirs. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
For the last couple of years, people across the southeast have faced one of the most severe droughts on record. In Georgia, you couldn't water your lawn. You couldn't wash your car in your driveway. The state even talked about shutting down swimming pools this year. And some worried the area would run out of drinking water. But one community didn't have to worry.
I like to say it's raining every day in Clayton County because we're putting, right now, about 10 million gallons back in our water supply.
Mike Thomas is general manager of the Clayton County Water Authority. He says reservoirs here are full and have never been in danger. That's because in the 1980s, folks realized there wasn't enough water to support the growth. So they decided to build a system of wetlands and reservoirs that would help them save water. In Jonesboro, Georgia, on a hilly patch of 4,000 acres, surrounded by tall pine trees, the county graded the land and built pools to filter the water. It's pumped in from a treatment plant and flows into a pond filled with all kinds of thick vegetation, including cattails, native grasses, and water lilies.
See right down here where the water's bubbling up? That's where the treated wastewater is entering the wetland cell, and then it'll gradually work its way through the entire cell, drop down to the next one, come back across, and usually work its way through about four cells. And that gives it plenty of exposure to the plants and the animals that kind of help remove any additional pollutants or nutrients that might still be in the water.
The water looks clear and doesn't smell bad. In fact, there have been no complaints from neighbors about the odor, but about something else entirely.
Really, the only complaint we've had was too much noise from the frogs at night. And so some of the noises you're hearing today, even during the daytime, are frog noises. So at night, when they really get active, it can really get noisy because there's so many frogs.
Before these wetlands were built, the county used an extensive sprinkler system, spraying wastewater in the forest and letting nature filter out the impurities. But Mike Thomas with the Clayton County Water Authority says the old system was expensive and the county was running out of forest land.
You know, before we were maintaining all these pipelines and sprinklers, now about the only maintenance activity we do out here is to mow the grass, and we usually only do that maybe two to three times during the summer. We're not trying to keep it like a manicured lawn. We're just trying to keep weeds and trees from growing up places we don't want them. So Mother Nature and gravity takes care of the rest.
From here, the water runs over a gate and into a reservoir, one of four that were built to store billions of gallons of water. Residents use about 26 million gallons of water a day, and through this system, the county is able to reclaim 10 million gallons of that. The price tag is also an advantage. It can be as little as half the cost of building a regular wastewater treatment plant. It probably won't work for bigger cities like Atlanta because you need a lot of land. Still, it's attractive for smaller communities, and there's an added benefit. Officials can create a nature preserve for those who live nearby. Kathy Lohr, NPR News, Atlanta.
Students at Oberlin College in Ohio are known to be an idealistic and opinionated bunch, but are they fearless? That's what the liberal arts school is telling prospective students in its brochures and on its website. As Dan Bobkoff of member station WCPN in Cleveland reports, some Oberlin students have been living up to the slogan in their fearless ridicule of the school's marketing strategy.
Like many colleges, Oberlin has for years pitched prospective students the notion that one person can change the world. But a few years ago, it hired a consultant to come up with something bolder, something that would help them stand out. The result is this statement: "We are Oberlin, fearless."
But I've never heard someone say, "Fearless, that's me."
Absolutely. It's awful.
That's freshman San Mayday Travis and her friend Rebecca Newman, who are hanging out in the sun today, listening to live bands outside the student center. Like most Oberlin students, they were kind of baffled by the whole fearless campaign. They feared it was an attempt to change this quirky school's image into something more mainstream, more appropriate for prep school kids and athletes. And then there are those who feel that Oberlin students are anything but fearless. Student Isabel Roth even wrote a song about it.
I'm not fearless, don't pretend I am. I am terrified of half a billion things.
And it's not just songs. There have been parody YouTube videos, protests, even t-shirts that replace the word fearless with awkward. None of that surprises Boston-based consultant Mark Edwards, even though he's the one who came up with the slogan.
Current students obviously are deeply loyal to the school they just attended and are often not particularly persuaded by someone from the outside trying to describe the place that they know and love so well.
But Edwards appears more amused than bothered. He knows this campaign is really aimed at people like Amelia Valadares.
I didn't think it was silly at all.
Valadares is a high school senior who's deciding whether to attend Oberlin or another school. If she comes here, she'll be in the first class to get the full fearless marketing treatment. It got her attention, at least.
I mean, I liked it, but still, it's marketing, and I know it's marketing.
And the fearless tagline does seem to be testing well with high schoolers. Besides, officials say, all those protests and parodies kind of prove one thing. Oberlin students truly are fearless. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. A charity with ties to Hillary Clinton has gotten in trouble for what appear to be illegal robocalls in North Carolina. That state's presidential primary is this Tuesday. The group, Women's Voices, Women Vote, says its goal is simply to register single women to vote. NPR's Peter Overby explains.
Last week, this automated robocall went out in North Carolina.
Hello, this is Lamont Williams. In the next few days, you will receive a voter registration packet in the mail. All you need to do is fill it out, sign it, date, and return your application. Then you will be able to vote and make your voice heard. Please return the registration form when it arrives. Thank you.
But the deadline to register for the primary had already passed, and the call went to many registered voters, people who were expecting to vote in the presidential primary next Tuesday. The call and follow-up mailings made many wonder whether they were registered for the primary or not. This sounds like a classic example of voter suppression, sowing confusion and driving down turnout. And these calls seem to be aimed at African-American communities, places where Barack Obama is expected to win easily. The group behind the calls is Women's Voices, Women Vote. It's a 501c3 charity, and the robocalls seem completely at odds with the group's usual upbeat message. Take this public service announcement. Julia Louis-Dreyfus strolls through a replica of the Oval Office, fantasizing about women electing a woman president.
Come on. Who do you want in here? You decide.
To register, go to wvwv.org.
Women's Voices, Women Vote did not make anyone available for comment on this story yesterday or today. Will Evans of the Center for Investigative Reporting, who collaborated in reporting this piece, found some Obama backers among the Women's Voices leadership, but the group mostly has ties to Hillary Clinton and her campaign. Founder Paige Gardner worked in Bill Clinton's 1992 campaign. Board member John Podesta was President Clinton's chief of staff. Maggie Williams, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, used to be on the Women's Voices leadership team and did consulting work for them.
That's all established. We can't show that there's any formal or direct connection.
This is Chris Crom, director of the Institute for Southern Studies in Durham, North Carolina. The Institute got complaints about the robocalls. Investigating those complaints led them to Women's Voices. The Institute turned up other complaints about the group, too, in Florida, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and four other states. The Virginia State Police investigated robocalls just before that state's primary. Again, Chris Crom.
What we have here is at least 5 months of a deceptive tactic, illegal in many states. And each time this group is criticized for this activity, they apologize for the confusion.
Meanwhile, the North Carolina Attorney General says the robocalls are illegal. State law requires that automated phone calls identify the sponsoring group and give the recipient a way to reach them. The Lamont Williams call did neither. Democracy North Carolina, a fair elections group, is working with Women's Voices to pull the 276,000 mailers out of the postal stream. Just a week ago, Paige Gardner wrote to the North Carolina Elections Board, letting them know about the calls and the mailing. She noted that Women's Voices would be raising the voter registration question just before the primary. She called it an unfortunate coincidence and said she hoped it wouldn't be confusing. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
If you've received strange robocalls or been contacted by so-called push polls, we'd like to hear about it. You can tell us about your experience at our website, npr.org/elections.
Americans swimming in debt are walking away from houses, and some are also having to give back the car keys. Auto loan delinquency is on the rise in the United States. It's good news for the repo man, bad news for everybody else, and it's our latest subject in this week's Conversations on Debt. We've contacted Philip Reed. He's a consumer advice specialist for the automotive information website Edmunds.com. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
How does the car mess compare to the mortgage mess?
Well, car delinquencies, auto loan delinquencies, are at a 17-year high right now, and most consumers are carrying much more debt for their car than ever before. We estimate that nearly a quarter of those people are upside down in their car loans.
Does that mean the same thing as being upside down in a mortgage? The car is worth less than what you owe on it?
That's right. And it also means that these people don't have much flexibility. In other words, they can't even walk away from the loan. They have to actually pay to get free of the debt that they have.
Although we should mention, isn't it normal with a car loan that you're upside down? As soon as you drive a new car off the lot, it's worth less than when you bought it?
Well, this is, sometimes the advice our fathers gave us was right. And generally what we were told was if you put 20% down when you purchase a car, you'll never be upside down. The problem is that people are looking for higher and higher end vehicles. People are buying more car when they're younger. So as a result, they're putting less down. They're keeping that money so that they can make car payments. So there has been a trend to being more upside down than ever before.
And has there been a trend among auto lenders to offer better and better terms to riskier and riskier clients?
Well, you need to use that term better advisedly. The cost of a car has risen in relationship to most people's earning power. As a result, the captive financing arms of manufacturers and
the financing companies that they themselves own.
Yes, that's right. That arm of the auto manufacturers have struggled to find ways to keep putting people in cars, so they've had to become more creative. Part of what they've done is they've gone more towards leasing. They've also extended the terms of the loans quite a bit.
I'm remembering right after 9/11, there were a lot of 0% financing deals that I think were seen as almost patriotic at the time, keeping the economy going.
Well, there is something patriotic. We're kind of actually encouraged to buy vehicles, to finance vehicles, to get more car than we need as kind of a patriotic move to keep the economy going, because the sale of automobiles is so important to the economy. It's an indicator that most financial experts look to.
But that leads to the next question. Are we getting close to some kind of crash in the auto loan market the way we've had in the mortgage market?
Actually, nothing has really changed in the auto loan market. They've been doing these kinds of things for years. But the crash in the real estate has sort of thrown a lot of emphasis on the people that are trying to keep up with their payments. My personal opinion is that there have been a lot of problems and abuses for quite a long time. Now with the problems in real estate, it's kind of highlighting and emphasizing those problems.
I'm remembering the last time that I bought a car. I ended up in an office with a guy, and he starts asking me about financing and ended up being a very high-pressure kind of annoying situation, but the guy's trying to sell me a loan as well as sell me a car. Is that the way it works for most people?
Yes. You go into the finance and insurance office, which is called F&I, and essentially you already believe that you've bought the car and you know all of the terms. But it's at this point that they begin to sell you extra products. They also begin to work on your loan. They may have a credit application already, but if you're not on your toes, they can actually inflate the interest rate at that point, and you can wind up paying quite a bit more than you should be paying.
Really? Is this the point in which a lot of Americans who are in trouble now got in trouble, even though they didn't realize it at the time?
The people that are victimized are people that have some problems with their credit rating. So they go into the F&I room and the finance officer says, we both know you've had a few problems, but you're nice people, so I'm going to take care of you. And it's right at that point that they begin to raise the interest rate. Say you qualify for 6%, they may sell it to you at 8 or 9%. So they're making quite a bit of money on you over the term of the loan.
It's like the guy's almost the good cop and the bad cop. He's telling you you're no good, but then offering you a deal that's not really a deal.
That's a good way to put it. The thing is that people feel very vulnerable about their finances, and if there's been a little bit of a problem, they magnify it, even though it may not have actually had any kind of an impact at all on their credit rating.
You ever been in trouble on a car loan?
No, I haven't. I've been in trouble on other things, so I know a little bit what it's like to get calls and how the tendency is to avoid dealing with the situation, which is the problem that's facing most people right now is that they don't want to answer the phone, they don't want to open the mail, they don't want to confront the problem that's in front of them, and that's a very negative situation to be in.
And do you think for most people it is possible to confront the problem?
Yes, they probably have a few more options than they realize, and of course one of them is selling the vehicle itself. There have been a number of people that have moved from, for example, a rather large SUV with a high loan. They've sold it off. Hopefully they had a little equity. They took that equity and put it down on a car that still got them back and forth to work and accomplished all the tasks they needed, but was at a much more reasonable loan terms for them.
Would you recommend that even if somebody is upside down, as you said, meaning they sell the car, they've still got a little bit to pay on the loan even after they apply the sale price to the loan?
Yes. I think that what people do need to be much more realistic about the vehicle that they buy and what they are willing to pay for it. It really begins with, first of all, deciding what you're going to be able to afford. People have been sold the American dream, which is a beautiful, sexy, hot car that's going to make everybody envy them. And now they're sort of paying the price for making a poor decision.
Philip Reed is consumer advice specialist for Edmunds.com. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
We've been talking all week about debt, and we conclude tomorrow with a look ahead. After years of easy credit, some Americans may get cut off.
Lenders are going to be much more targeted in who they extend credit to, how much credit they extend to everybody, and under what terms.
Oh, if you're fed up with the American stock market or the real estate market, consider this attractive business opportunity. Plans for an amusement park, a four-star hotel, apartment buildings, and infrastructure for a dozen cities. But there are risks, namely mortar, rocket, and small arms fire, occasional car bombings, and kidnappings. Baghdad is attracting a small but growing number of what you might call adventure capitalists, as NPR's Eric Westerfeld reports.
Al-Zawra Park and Zoo, the sprawling complex in the heart of Baghdad, is open again, its ramshackle playgrounds and decrepit coffee shops slowly lurching back to life. But Los Angeles entrepreneur Llewellyn Werner has a bigger vision, a $500 million Disney-style water park. In a conference room in Zawra Park, he pitches his plan to a deputy Baghdad mayor.
At Disneyland, they shoot the water into the air as a mist, and they project pictures on the water. And the people go, oh my gosh. I can't believe this. We're going to do the same thing here. It's very exciting.
Deputy Mayor Ibrahim Hussein looks intrigued, yet a little skeptical. We'll have to check all the designs, he says. Werner is undeterred.
One piece of marketing advice. The lagoons are very important.
Yeah. Yeah.
They are integral
I agree.
To the sex appeal, yes. the sizzle. Anybody here been to Disneyland?
We've seen it on TV.
Okay.
At least we have an idea.
Sizzle, sex appeal? Rockets and mortars still regularly fall near Zawra Park, more than half of which is inside the heavily protected Green Zone, a near-daily target of Shiite militants and Sunni insurgents. Werner and his company, C3 Invest, recently purchased a 50-year lease from the city of Baghdad for the 50-acre park. It gives his company exclusive rights to hotel and housing development inside the park. Werner won't say what he paid for the lease as he strolls past the murky, overgrown lagoons filled with half-sunken debris.
But if you take a walk, as you're doing with me right now, if you can imagine for a moment a little bit better sightscape, some attractions, down the road maybe some mixed-use housing shops, kind of like a universal walkway of concept, this is perfect.
Visionary, opportunist, or something else? Werner insists he's just an aggressive American businessman, eager to defy the skeptics.
They go, what? But you begin to explain to them the enormous opportunity of a country of 26 million people who are going to be spending anywhere between $80 and $100 billion in the next 5 years rebuilding their society from the ground up.
Werner's company also is investing in new fiber optic lines here and a 500-megawatt power plant outside Baghdad. We're never going to shoot our way out of Iraq, Werner says. The only way out of here is to employ these young men, he says, give them something to lose. Brigadier General Mike Milano agrees. The deputy commander of the 4th Infantry Division, which is in charge of Baghdad, says job creation is central to the U.S. counterinsurgency strategy.
It's sustainable employment for military-aged males,
give them something constructive to do with their lives, as opposed to, you know, putting IEDs in the road or taking, you know, sniper shots at soldiers and so forth.
Llewellyn Werner is one of 8 American entrepreneurs who set up new business ventures in Iraq after encouragement and help by the Defense Department's Paul Brinkley. He directs the Pentagon's task force to improve business and stability operations in Iraq.
It's not combat tourism by any stretch. They're coming here, they're serious, they want to start businesses, they want to invest, they want to get in on ground floor because it's going to be an extremely prosperous country.
Brinkley says Iraq today is an untapped prospect, in business jargon, a greenfield opportunity.
This may be one of the last great greenfield business opportunities in the world, you know, where there's a huge potential return on investment if you get in early, if you have the appetite for risk.
Guys such as Rand Holtz do. A former U.S. Army sergeant, Holtz reenlisted in the Army after 9/11 and fought in Iraq in 2004. He's now back as a civilian project manager for a veteran-owned $25 million hedge fund called the Iraq Fund. Holtz shows us around some of the properties his companies bought in central Baghdad.
There's 20 rooms in this building that we control. There's 34 in the building across the street. And then
the former soldier is something of a high-end fixer for U.S. and Arab Gulf investors who want eyes and feet on the ground inside Iraq, just not their own eyes and feet. In addition to the Iraq Fund, Holtz is a lobbyist, business developer, and manager for 4 other companies. For Holtz, that means a tricky balance, working with senior Iraqi government and business officials, all while trying to keep a low profile and doing what you must in a country whose banking system is in tatters. If that means moving $500,000 cash on the ground in a shoulder bag, so be it.
Unarmed with 2 people in a soft vehicle downtown Baghdad, and I've done that on several occasions. $500,000, about 18, 19 pounds. Anything more than that in a small bag gets a little bit difficult to manage if you have to leave the vehicle and go on foot.
Holtz is working to land some of the big infrastructure contracts in Iraq, but you have to have the basic networks to support them.
The problem is if Iraq doesn't have the infrastructure that it needs to move forward, the small things that you want to do and enjoy in the streets will be there. But you know, being able to reprocess wastewater, secure a potable drinking water for the masses, to produce electricity for more than 6 or 8 hours a day, those are the larger concerns.
Watchdog groups are concerned, too, about Iraq's notoriously corrupt ministries and business culture and the spotty track record of some American firms in Iraq. U.S. congressional investigators allege that as much as $10 billion charged by U.S. contractors for Iraq reconstruction was ill-spent or questionable. As Scott Amy with the Project on Government Oversight put it, quote, "The question is whether a private company can do what the federal government can't, adequately oversee the contracts and reconstruction efforts to ensure that money isn't wasted and that the Iraqi people benefit from the investment," end quote. And Iraqis investigating Iraqi government corruption here continue to be targeted. On Tuesday, the director of the Iraqi Ministry of Labor was assassinated in a roadside bombing as he left his Baghdad home. Abdullah Alami was in charge of the ministry's reconstruction department and was investigating corruption in the ministry. Back at the business pitch meeting, Llewellyn Werner hopes to see 1,000 skateboards bloom in Baghdad.
One of the fastest growing sports in the world is called skateboarding.
The CEO of C3 tells the assembled group he plans to develop the new entertainment complex over 5 years, but he's starting off slowly with thousands of free skateboards and big new skating ramps. Few Iraqis seem to know of the sport, but never mind. In July, Werner will give the boards away, along with much-needed helmets and knee pads.
More people will come to this complex than you can ever imagine once it catches on.
After explaining skateboarding, Werner tells the assembled Iraqi business and government men, quote, "I'm a businessman. I'm not here because I think you're nice people. I think there's money to be made here." Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Baghdad.